I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
They swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
Yeah, we both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great, yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Tim Draxel is an actor and singer whose career has spanned more than two decades. He has accomplished that rare thing for actors. His work has been able to confidently traverse the fields of film, television, cabaret and theatre, musicals and plays, with ease, success and tremendous skill. Most recently, he was seen in the SBS anthology television series Erotic Stories and then the lead role in ABC's four-part musical drama In Our Blood. On stage, Tim was most recently seen in Belvoir's Into the Woods as Cinderella's Prince and the Wolf, and in the role of Steve Healy for the first overseas tour of Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill. Other theatre credits include the critically acclaimed Only Heaven Knows, Catch Me If You Can, Torch Song Trilogy, and The Sound of Music. Further television credits include anthology series Summer Love and critically acclaimed The Newsreader, the hit series A Place to Call Home, as series regular Dr. Henry Fox, the Molly Meldrum telemovie Molly, and The Sharknet. His film work includes action film Blacklight alongside Liam Neeson, A Few Best Men, Travelling Light, Swimming Upstream, and Dirty Deeds. Tim's cabaret work is extensive, and he has released four solo albums. Tim Draxel can currently be seen on Australian stages, playing the role of Joe Gillis, opposite Sarah Brightman's Norma Desmond, in the much-anticipated new production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Sunset Boulevard. Tim Draxel, welcome to Stages.
Thank you, Peter.
What's the weather like in Melbourne today?
It's crisp, cold, wintry, but fresh. It's lovely.
We love it. We love it. Of course, it's the very first day of your performance in front of an audience for this new, dynamic, magnificent new production of Sunset Boulevard. Are you ready for your close-up?
Yes. Well played. Well played. I am very ready for my close-up. I think we're all ready for our close-up. It's been, you know, an amazing kind of 8-week process of getting to this point. And, you know, it's always fun to kind of, it's like show and tell, right? When you were a kid, you kind of work on something so hard. It's the anticipation and the excitement of actually putting in front of people and showing them what we've been working on, you know, the kind of big reveal. It's incredibly exciting. Yeah.
I was listening on Instagram this morning to you singing the title song, Sunset Boulevard, which you've obviously been into a studio to do, and it sounds, you sound fantastic.
Oh, thank you. It's, I'm actually, you know, there's not a lot of things in my career that I look back on and go, I'm proud of that. There are kind of key moments that I'm really happy with. And I think that's probably one of them. You know, it's, as a performer, you get opportunities, you know, some better than others, and this is certainly one of those ones that when I was offered the role, I kind of had to take a moment and go, oh, can I actually do this? You know, when I listened to the recording and the score and just the workload that is involved with this show and this role in particular, you know, I really had to kind of sit myself down and go, are you ready for this? Are you sure you can do this? So to be at this point now, to be putting in front of an audience, yeah, I'm incredibly proud. And you know, I hope it all works. But yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Well, the role of Joe Gillis is a huge role. I mean, you're rarely off the stage. I mean, look, we know you're a pretty fit fella anyway, but how do you, you pace yourself for a role like Joe? You know, it requires a degree of physical and vocal fitness to maintain that 8 shows a week.
100%. And, you know, 8 shows a week isn't something that sits comfortably with me. You know, I've kind of been in the world of film and television for so long that, you know, it's a specific kind of mental focus and you're right, it's a kind of pacing yourself to kind of have that stamina of 8 shows a week. It doesn't sit naturally with me. You know, the joy of film and television is you go into work every day and every day is completely different. You work on, you know, particular scenes, you kind of perfect them, you get them right, and then they're kind of in the bag and they're done and you kind of move on to the next thing. You know, when it's musical theatre in particular, with, you know, when singing is involved as well, it is, you know, it's a certain skill set to kind of make that fresh and alive every night. And it is something that I really have to focus on. You know, some people are geared that way and I have such respect for them, you know, for those people who kind of live in the world of musical theatre, you know, for most of their careers. It's an incredible feat to kind of, to be able to do that every night.
Yeah. You mentioned your film and television work. You would be what I describe a rare beast as an actor in the world. Well, and in particular Australia, probably, in that, hear me out, you're able to cross many platforms with it would seem apparent ease. You know, film, television, cabaret, musical theatre, yeah, plays and musicals. What do you put that down to? Because it requires, as you sort of just described, a sense of recalibration for the platform that you are then performing in.
Yeah, you know, to be honest, it hasn't always been easy, and certainly at the beginning of my career, there was a very, you know, I guess the industry has changed so much, right, since the onset of the internet and YouTube and people and Instagram and kind of people forging their own careers and kind of being able to promote themselves on all kinds of different platforms. You know, when I started out, you know, I started as a singer, I started in musical theater and, you know, back then the industry and certainly in the public sphere, in the kind of public view, you got pigeonholed very quickly as a musical theatre performer. And it was very difficult to convince people that you were other things as well, that you could do other things, you know. And trying to break into film and television, which was incidentally always kind of my main passion. The musical theatre kind of thing happened quite by accident. It wasn't something that I really sought out, although I always loved musical theatre and, you know, I grew up watching, you know, the old movie musicals and I wanted to be Gene Kelly. It kind of found me and it took a concerted effort to try and to break away from that and to make people see me as something other than just a musical theatre performer. I mean, so much so that I literally, you know, I did one musical theatre show or two, I think I did She Loves Me was my first ever professional gig, which was down here in Melbourne with a production company. And I did that and then I did The Sound of Music, which was the Susan Schulman production that came to Australia from Broadway and I played Rolf, the telegram boy. And after that, I was kind of labeled in press and all the interviews that I did as a musical theatre performer, which was odd to me because after Sound of Music and I kind of moved into film and television and, you know, and I had released a couple of albums, and it still was what I was kind of labeled as, was a musical theatre performer. And even though I hadn't done musical theatre at that point for so long, you know, and so it was, you know, it wasn't easy at the beginning, but then at some point you kind of go, you know, I'm following my own dream, my own passions, and I'm, you know, focusing on what I want to do. And I don't know whether it's manifestation or whatever you want to call it, but it all kind of just clicked and fell into place. And I'm not saying it was easy. You know, there were, you know, long periods of time where I didn't work, but it was just a matter of kind of saying no to particular things in order to pursue other things. And now, you know, it's quite, I kind of am able to shift quite comfortably from one to the other. And I think it's more common now, I think, for performers to be able to do that. But, you know, there was a period where, you know, if you were a musical theatre performer, that's what you did. If you were a TV actor, that's what you did. But now it's more fluid, and I think it's a really great thing.
If only you weren't blessed with a glorious voice, life would be so much easier.
Oh, yes, wouldn't it? I don't know about glorious voice, but, you know, I'm...
Well, it is. It's a great voice. It's a versatile voice. If you think of the last couple of musicals that you've done, Jagged Little Pill and Into the Woods, they both required, as does Sunset Boulevard, a particular style of singing.
Yeah, 100%. And Sunset is very different, again, you know, to the other two shows that you just mentioned. And... you know, and it's required a lot of work to, you know, I'm not going to kind of deny it. It's, I haven't ever had to sing this much in my entire life. I mean, like you said, Joe Gillis is on stage pretty much the entire show. There's, you know, there's one moment in Act Two where I get to be off stage, which I was hoping would be, you know, a lovely moment for me to kind of go down to my dressing room, you know, have a moment to myself. But no, at that point, I'm doing a quick change in the wings before I re-enter. So it's, you know, it's one of those shows where you start the journey and it's like a roller coaster. You can't get off, and you can't think about anything else. You know, if something goes wrong, I had a moment in one of the dress runs recently where I, you know, I wasn't happy with something I did, and I was thinking about that, and it really distracted me. And I realized I can't actually do that. I don't have the time, you know, to be able to linger on what is in the past. I really just have to press on with what's in front of me. And it's just kind of go, 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 go.
Well, yeah. Sunset Boulevard, that very first production premiered in Australia in 1996.
Yeah.
Tim Draxler was 15 years of age. Did you get to see that show with Deborah Byrne and Hugh Jackman, Maria Mercedes?
No, I wish I had of, because, you know, it's kind of a legendary performance, you know, in the industry, and people still talk about it with great reverence and respect, and I wish I had have gotten to see it. I've seen little snippets. There are some, you know, cheeky little videos on YouTube with Amanda Harris and Hugh Jackman. And yeah, it's, you know, it's a tough thing to live up to. But I think our production is, as you said, it's a completely new imagining. It's a brand new design. You know, the characters, I think, are coloured quite differently, and, you know, which is kind of comes naturally, I guess, with the people that you cast in the roles. I think, you know, I bring a very different colour to Joe than Hugh Jackman brought, or anyone, you know, previously. And likewise with Sarah and Sarah Brightman and Sylvie Palladino. It's, you know, and even in themselves, Sylvie and Sarah's interpretation of Norma are very different. So, you know, it's certainly keeping me on my toes.
the narrative is a well-worn trope, which we all love. I mean, it's a little bit Pygmalion. It's a little bit Beauty and the Beast. And it's a romance of sorts, I mean, with Joe and Norma, but also Joe and Betty Schaefer.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. And Pygmalion is kind of something that, we refer to quite a lot in the rehearsal room, because, you know, the transformation of Joe is very similar to that, you know, and Norma kind of creates this character for her own narrative in her, you know, in her head. And Joe kind of leans into that and at points of it, you know, at one point in particular, kind of almost enjoys playing that role for her, you know. And then, of course, Betty Schaefer comes along and disrupts that and, you know, is kind of faced with the awful truth of, you know, having kind of lost himself to this role that he had been playing for Norma's sake. And then having to kind of piece himself back together, which is, you know, an interesting dichotomy and you know, psychologically, I think a really interesting journey to go on. Because I think it's true of humans in general. We all sacrifice, you know, parts of ourselves to be in a relationship and you know, some more than others. And I think it's a really interesting thing to kind of explore.
The source material is, of course, that classic film by Billy Wilder. Mm. Pauline Kael, the great film critic, said of that film, "The whole enterprise exudes decadence like a stale, exotic perfume. You might not want to smell it every day, but then in 1950, you didn't get the chance. It was certainly a change from oceans of rose water, lilies of San Fernando Valley, and the scrubbed, healthy look." Billy Wilder's film took a sharp turn from what we were usually seeing in films about Los Angeles.
Yeah. Which I think, you know, I mean, it was groundbreaking, right? It was the first time that a film had explored Hollywood itself, you know, and kind of turned the cameras inward and looked at the world that Hollywood had created for itself, which was fascinating. And you know, we kind of take it for granted now, I think. But back then, you know, you kind of have to imagine that there was no other film that had really explored that territory or that concept of the Hollywood machine and what it had done to people, you know, that were kind of caught up in the industry. You know, and he, Billy Wilder, I mean, it's such a fabulous movie and one of my favorite all-time films. So, you know, again, to be able to put this show on stage is just a dream come true. But, you know, he got a lot of flack. Billy Wilder got a lot of pushback from the industry and, you know, people thought he'd really thrown the industry under the bus or, you know, kind of deceived them and betrayed his own kind by putting that on the big screen. But I think the people who responded to it in that way really missed the point of it, because essentially it is still a love letter to Hollywood and to the industry that Billy Wilder loved. And I think that's what resonates most with me in it. You know, you sometimes in life you lose the sight of your dreams and you get distracted by other things, by, you know, shiny things and glittery things and by money or, you know, and at some point I think you come back around and you have to go, oh, why did I get into this business? And those are the things that will kind of, you know, sustain you.
We've certainly seen the shiny side of Hollywood with films like Singing in the Rain, but post Sunset,
which came after Sunset Boulevard, right? Singing in the Rain was, you know, kind of almost a response to Sunset Boulevard, because it was again a film within a film, and until Sunset Boulevard, that concept had never been explored. Singing in the Rain, which was incidentally the first movie musical I ever saw, so that really was the start of my career. I had a VHS copy of it, which was introduced by, I think it was Bill Collins, right? Do you remember those midday movies, right?
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of my fascination with song and dance and Gene Kelly and you know, the golden age of the musical. But it had this kind of like beautiful, glossy, colorful veneer of, you know, of what Hollywood was and the star machine. It's interesting when you hold those two examples up against each other.
A vast spectrum. Then in the middle, films like Valley of the Dolls and The Player and The Artist. Great films which shine a light on the underbelly, the seedy side of filmmaking. You've obviously spent some time in LA and Hollywood. How did you find LA? It's an industry town very much, isn't it?
Oh, my God. It's a beast of its own. I mean, LA, I lived in LA for 7 years. I lived there for 5 years. Left because LA had really broken me. I came back to Australia and put the pieces back together again, which took, I think, about 3 years before I was able to kind of face LA again or feel strong enough, you know, and secure enough within myself and who I was to go back to LA. And I went back for another 2 years. And then just really decided that it wasn't a place for me. You know, I have a lot of friends in LA still and a lot of Australian friends who went over and really clicked with LA, like it really worked for them. For me, you know, whether it was a lack of being able to focus or being too enticed by the shiny side of Hollywood, you know, and going to the parties and, you know, laying out in the sun every day by the pool and living that kind of lifestyle, I wasn't able to focus on the reason that I had gone to LA in the first place. You know, I remember when I was younger, when I first started going to LA, when I was like, you know, I would have been like 17, 18. And I recorded my second album in LA at Capitol Records. And I had an agent over there and, I remember vividly sitting on that airplane flying into LA and flying over, you know, over the city and just going, this time I'm going to conquer you. You know, this is going to be the trip that kind of solidifies my place in this industry. And it just never quite worked. And, you know, when I moved there in I think it was 2006, I did a couple of films over there, some independent films, and it just never really worked for me. So it was, you know, it's a really hard town that is completely and solely built on the industry. You know, that old kind of, stereotype of going to a cafe and nobody's a waiter, nobody's, you know, everyone's an actor. And it's true. Everyone is trying to break into the industry, whether it's in producing, directing, acting. You know, everyone wants their moment of fame and of glory. And it's a dog eat dog world. It's brutal. And you know, when I first started going to LA, I'd walk into an audition room and you know, casting directors would kind of greet me with this, you know, with open arms and go, oh my God, we've heard so much about you. We've been trying to get you into the room for so long. Thank you so much for coming. And then, you know, by the end of my time in LA, I'd walk into an audition room and they'd barely look up from their piece of paper and just go, yep, okay, do the scene. You know, and it really, that toys with your self-confidence, and I'd really lost so much of that in LA. So you know, that's kind of one of the reasons why I ended up coming back to Australia.
Yeah, it can be an unforgiving business, can't it? No wonder you're broken. You've got to have a thick skin and a resilience. It's a psychological game.
And you've got to, you know, you've got to kind of hold on to your dreams because everything around you will try and destroy that dream in this industry, which is, you know, the industry itself is kind of, you know, it's, you know, it almost destroys itself in a way. It you know, unless you are able to hold on to those, you know, those threads of why you wanted to do this in the first place, it really can break you. And what I love is that I've been through all of that, and I still want to be in this industry, which is much like Billy Wilder, right? Yeah. He went through all of that and put it all into a film and still, you know, wanted to be part of that because he hadn't lost sight of his dreams. And that's what Joe Gillis is to me. And that's why I'm kind of loving playing this role, is because I've been where Joe has been. You know, I have been on a bus in LA with my last dollar trying to get to an audition, running incredibly late because the public transport system in LA is shocking, you know, I've walked in his shoes, or I feel like I've walked in his shoes, and then to kind of come out the other end and go, even despite all of that, I still love the magic of this industry and what we get to do. You know, we had a moment in the SITS probe the other week, you know, where we all get up for the first time and sing the whole show with the orchestra for the first time.
Exciting time.
Oh, my God, we were in tears. I mean, apart from the fact that Andrew Lloyd Webber's score is just so magical. I mean, this score is, you know, it's so cinematic and so informative of, you know, of each character's journey. Right. And it's hard to do that when somebody's kind of only playing it on a piano, when you have the strings and the winds and the, you know, and the percussion and the timpani, that what that evokes in you as a human, you know, is it brought us all to tears. Like, we were all in tears and it was magical. And you go, oh, we're so lucky to do what we do, yeah. You know, to tell stories and to, you know, to kind of inspire people the way that, you know, Singing in the Rain inspired me, and seeing, you know, Phantom of the Opera for the first time, which was the first live show that I ever saw, you know, what that did to me as a kid, and went, oh my God, I want to be part of this world. Yeah.
Special. Cinematic is a great description for the score. And look, I was amazed to see that a long time before Lord Lloyd Webber transformed the film into a musical, Gloria Swanson had actually commissioned a musical called Boulevard.
Yeah, yeah.
Not long after the film, she wanted to turn it into it, and Stephen Sondheim had a go at it as well.
Yeah, a lot of people had a go at it, and it never got off the ground. And I think, I mean, I would love to have seen what that musical would have been that Gloria Swanson had put together. Like, imagine what that would have been. But, you know, everything happens for a reason, and subsequently we've, you know, got this masterpiece of a show that Andrew Lloyd Webber's written, and it's pretty phenomenal.
A masterpiece of a show which requires a diva of sorts to play that role of Norma mm-hmm. Desmond. I mean, and many of the greats have had a go over the Patti LuPone, Glenn Close. Yeah. Betty Buckley, Petula Clark, Diane Carroll, Leland Page, Rita Moreno, Alan Schneider, and in Australia, we're blessed to have, you know, one of the greats also, Sarah Brightman. How has it been working with Miss Brightman?
Oh, look, I think with anyone of that kind of, that stardom and that magnitude, there's an apprehension and a trepidation that you kind of have before you meet them. You know, I remember a similar feeling when I was working with Judy Davis on one of the first films I ever did, which was Swimming Upstream many, many years ago. And you know, that feeling on set the day that they arrive, and everyone's incredibly tense. And, you know, it is literally like people are on their walkie-talkies going, the eagle has landed. And it was similar with Sarah, you know, but then you very quickly, you know, especially in Sarah's case, you realize very quickly that they're people, they're humans. They have the same, you know, nerves and apprehensions and you know, all those same things that we all deal with, they have exactly the same thing. No matter how big the star is, they still get nervous. They still get, you know, scared. They still, and, you know, and everyone is the same. I still get nervous. I still get, you know, worried about the first performance and what everyone's going to think, you know, in the rehearsal room. And, Sarah was incredibly down to earth, incredibly open to exploring, and there's an incredibly and beautiful, beautifully playful side to Sarah. You know, when she does these little dances and things, and you know, it's great fun. She has a wicked sense of humor. So she and I are getting along very well.
We're very fortunate in Australia in that, you know, Opera Australia, not so long ago, a couple of years, 3 years maybe, did a new production of Phantom of the Opera on the Harbour,
yeah,
which was a break from that traditional Hal Prince production that we all saw. Mm. And that they're giving us a brand new production of Sunset Boulevard, which is not the Trevor Nunn production. So that must be very exciting to be part of that and to contribute to how you want your Joe Gillies to be, Joe Gillies.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we don't get the opportunity in Australia very often to do that. You know, certainly in a big kind of production like this, and similarly with Phantom. You know, oftentimes shows that come to Australia are overseas productions that get transferred here. So you kind of, there's a degree, and not exclusively, but there's a degree of having to fit a certain mold, right? There's a kind of blueprint of the show where you're required to deliver a line from here because this is where the light is, or you're required to use this certain prop because that's the prop that was used in, you know, previous production. So there's, I wouldn't say rigidness, but it's there's a certain kind of formula that you're working with, right? And with that becomes there comes a little bit of a, I guess, limitation of what you can do, you know. And I mean, I've heard it off, you know, I've heard performers, you know, friends of mine who are, you know, in various productions of overseas transfers that have come to Australia, you know, kind of go, oh, no, they've said that we've got, you know, kind of creative liberty and we can totally make these characters our own. But then when you get into the rehearsal studio, there's, you know, there's a certain kind of manipulation of that where, you know, you're kind of guided or directed in a certain way towards what the, you know, character had been previously. With this, with productions like this, you know, to be able to start from the ground up with no, you know, kind of preconceived idea of what it is other than what is on the page, right? And what the character is from the film, you know, which is where I go back to. It's a huge honor and a massive responsibility as well. And I certainly felt that going into this, you know, to create something brand new is so thrilling. And Paul Warwick Griffin, our wonderful director, I will have to say it's been one of the most collaborative experiences I think I've ever had, with really, you know, kind of diving into and dialing up certain characteristics of Joe that, you know, perhaps haven't been explored, you know, and what I mean is, you know, all those kind of experiences that I've had in LA, right? To be able to put those on the table and bring those into the room and, you know, and go, I know what this desperation feels like. I know how much this means, you know, to someone who's trying to kind of get a foot in the door and you know, get a leg up. So it's so exciting. And similarly with Sarah, it's a completely different interpretation of Norma Desmond. It's not the Norma Desmond that, you know, Glenn Close did or Betty Buckley, or, you know, it's it's very different. And you know, and I kind of implore people to come with an open mind, because it isn't going to be what we remember it to be from, you know, from the production that had been in, has been in Australia before, or the recordings that you've heard, or, you know, it's a new production. It's a new interpretation.
Yeah. You're serving it up to a huge fan base. There's a lot of anticipation out there to see it. And as your advice is so correct too, I think, you know, we've been so exposed to the, I mean, this is the best way to describe it, the McDonald's musicals, which may have originated in London or America, and they're brilliant pieces of artistry. But of course, when they tour to every other capital city in the world, it is exactly the same. It's the same show that you would see in on Broadway or on the West End or whatever. So we've been robbed from having new life breathed into classic productions of musical theatre because of the original producers holding, you know, that production together. So to have the opportunity to see a new Sunset Boulevard is just wonderful.
Yeah, it is. It's and to be able to do it in Australia is, you know, it's rare. So I cherish it, and I, you know, it's so exciting. And you know, in saying that, that's not to diminish, you know, what you refer to as the kind of that McDonald's kind of you know, idea
that franchise musical or something.
Yeah, but it, you know, and obviously each performer brings a certain color to, you know, brings their own color to creating their role. But it is like, you know, it's when you see the set and the, you know, you see little snippets of videos and it's like, oh, they put the jacket down there and it's exactly the same. In, you know, there's a certain mechanical aspect to it, but you know, it isn't to say that those performances aren't incredible, and you know, they're working their butts off and or any of those things, but it's a different beast to kind of start, you know, start something from scratch and also daunting. And I think, you know, we're very lucky that we've had as much time as we've had to kind of dive into this production and to explore different things and try different things. And we've tried things and go, oh, that doesn't work. That's terrible. You know? Can't wait to see what the audience thinks.
I know. It's fantastic. Hey, listen, let's talk about television for a minute. And bravo on your work in Our Blood. I mean, that was breaking new ground as a television show, because it had that musical component in it as well, which was terrific, a way of highlighting the drama of the piece.
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, on so many levels, it was such a wonderful project to be part of. The musical element certainly, and I love that I didn't sing a note. which, you know, it was scripted that I sing at the end. And I had kind of spoken to the director and the producer and said, I really don't want to sing at the end, because I don't want it to be, you know, oh, that's why he was cast, was because he can sing as well. And that's, you know, so I didn't sing at the end. But it was also groundbreaking in that, you know, the producers from the beginning were very adamant that this story be told, you know, a story about queer history, Australian queer history in particular, was told by queer people. So all the queer roles were all played by queer people. You know, we had most of the crew were part of the LGBTQI plus community, and certainly allies, if not members. But it was a wonderful experience and such an important part of Australian history that not a lot of people knew. I knew nothing about it. You know, what we had done, what Australia had done during that period, which was so groundbreaking and revolutionary and saved so many lives. You know, it was really a moment in Australian history where we got it right. And it was something that I think Australia should know about and should feel very proud about.
Yeah. advances in battling that that holds AIDS epidemic period. Look, you talk about the queer representation in that show, but Erotic Stories and your character in Summer Love and The Newsreader, you've certainly been at the forefront of presenting queer characters on screen. Do you ever feel like that you're the go-to guy for those roles, or they just come across your agent's desk and just like any other role, you throw your hat in your ring?
Yeah, it is really just a case of, you know, those roles come along and you throw your hat in the ring, and I wouldn't say that I'm the go-to. I love that let me say it this way, it's been incredibly liberating to be able to kind of embrace my sexuality in my work, right? I didn't come out really until 2011. And, you know, up until that point, I was very much in the closet, very much worried about who knew that I was gay, you know, and keeping it out of the media and all that kind of stuff. And then in 2011, I was doing a film with Stephen Elliott called A Few Best Men, with Xavier Samuel and Kevin Bishop and some other wonderful comedians, and Olivia Newton-John and Rebel Wilson. And Stefan, who I'd known for years prior to that, and it was the first time we were working together, and he kind of outed me in a very casual and unintentional way in the rehearsal period. And I just remember that. I remember that day so vividly, and my heart sank, and I was like, oh my God, what have you done? And of course, what he'd done was liberate and lift a massive weight off my shoulders. Because then after that, it was like, I didn't care. And I kind of thought, no, this is who I am. And, you know, like it or lump it, you know, if you've got a problem with it, then that problem is yours and not mine. And then, of course, from there, going on to A Place to Call Home, playing a gay role, and for the first time actually going, you know what, I want to talk about this in my interviews, you know, and subsequently it's meant a lot, not only to myself, but to a lot of other people too. You know, when I was doing A Place to Call Home, I got a lot of fan mail from playing Dr. Henry Fox, from people all over the world, you know, kind of thanking me for being, you know, proud about who I was and you know, kind of bringing that into my work, you know, and it was the first time that those two worlds, which had been previously incredibly separated, where I was able to be myself on set. You know, I could sit in a makeup chair and talk about, you know, going on dates with guys. I didn't have to pretend that they were women, and I didn't have to kind of just not use gender. I could actually, you know, and then, you know, eventually when I met my partner 7 years ago, I could talk about him freely, and it was, you know, bringing him to set and taking him on red carpets. And that was like, makes me tear up thinking about it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. Somewhere else where you can be yourself also is the cabaret platform. You're up there. It's just you and the music and the audience. What do you love about that genre of performance?
Oh, look, I love the casualness of it. I love, you know, essentially what we do is storytelling. One of the reasons that I always wanted to become a performer was that I was never good with words. I was never good at kind of expressing myself through my own words. And I always, you know, found, you know, a song or a film that I'd listen to or hear and go, oh, that's how I feel. And that put into words what I have been trying to say, right? And with cabaret, I'm able to select those songs that resonate with me, that you know, kind of take me back to a particular time or a particular feeling that I had, or how I view the world, or how I think about love or relationships, or, you know, all those things. And I'm essentially kind of almost curating my own musical, right? Because I'm telling a story through those songs. And then, you know, the kind of intimacy of casually being able to talk about why that song is important to me or what it means to me, it's just a lovely, you know, kind of thing to share with an audience. You know, it's very personal, and that's, you know, and I love that aspect of it.
Yeah.
And also it's, you know, you get to kind of like call the shots, right? It's your show. So you get to choose the material and go, no, I want to do this and I want to do it this way. That's why I love it.
Great material that I saw you explore was in the recent short-lived Sydney Cabaret Festival when you did a show called Love is a Drag, which was based on a historic album.
Yeah.
Fabulous show, fabulous concept for a show.
Yeah. And that, yeah, it was. And again, something, you know, I guess it's one of those kind of things of in history and you just think, oh, how did we ever get through this? Right. And we're talking about 1964 when this album came out, and it was, you know, it had a cult following. It was kind of had an underground world around it because it was a collection of songs, man-to-man love songs, essentially, songs that were usually sung by women, like The Man That Got Away or The Boy Next Door, usually sung by women, and in this case were sung by a man. And they didn't change the gender, which, you know, from my own experience of starting cabaret when I was 16, I always changed the gender to she or her. And you know, at one point in my career, I stopped doing that. And, you know, and that wasn't until I met my partner, my current partner. So it was, you know, only 7 years ago, about then. So to have this album that was, you know, a man singing about loving a man in 1964, when it was, you know, was still a criminal offense to, you know, to love someone of the same gender, was just phenomenal. I mean, it was, you know, Liberace's favorite album, which is, you know, not surprising, but, you know, there were a lot of other people that really loved the album, including Frank Sinatra, and, you know, there's a great story about Frank and his buddies, you know, listening to it because they loved the album, which also is just kind of like, you think, they were open-minded people back then, right? Yeah. There were people that just were like, who cares? You're gay, whatever. But they would try and guess who the singer was because nobody knew who the singer was. And the singer himself wasn't revealed until, when was it? Like 2014 or something.
Yeah.
In a newspaper article, which is how it kind of came to my attention. But they would sit around, Frank Sinatra and his mates would sit around and try and guess who the singer was, who'd kept his name off the album because he was worried that he was going to get arrested. And the guy who sang it was actually straight and had children. And, you know, it turned out to be more of a publicity stunt by a new record label that was trying to make their mark on the music industry. But it, you know, it ended up kind of creating this, you know, cult following. And the show that we did around that was, you know, the amazing Daniel Edmonds, who's now gone off, he's on Broadway opening Great Gatsby. He was the musical director on that and I miss him terribly. It was a beautiful show, that he and I put together, and Bryce Hallett, who wrote the book, and we kind of connected it with all these they were fictional kind of letters that were based on true stories. So it was also an acting opportunity for me, you know, to kind of tell these stories in the voices of these people that were living through that period, you know, through you know, like through World War II or whatever, and also incorporated the story of Rock Hudson and you know, that Hollywood era of the 50s where people, you know, were very much in the closet and you couldn't be out. So it was an interesting kind of era to explore.
Yeah. And remind me, when you first arrived on the scene, there was a song that you used to do by that great cabaret artist, Nancy Lamott.
Mm-hmm.
What, you remember the name of that?
It was either Listen With Your Heart or We Live on Borrowed Time.
Yes, that's it. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Which was so, I mean, as a 16-year-old singing We Live on Borrowed Time was so outrageously precocious, but...
A lot of those. There's another great artist, sadly no longer with us, but yes, yeah, what a voice.
Phenomenal. Yeah. Incredible.
So first audience tonight, do you have I know it's not opening night, it's the first preview audience, but do you have an opening night routine, something that you go through?
No, I mean, I will say I'm usually just generally always running late.
Right.
Which, you know, anyone who knows me will attest to. But no, I don't have a ritual as such. I mean, no, I really don't. No.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, that's a short answer.
Yeah. I mean, I have my little things and quirks that I, you know, I kind of need to make sure I, you know, brush my teeth before a show and, you know, those kind of little things, but nothing really major. But I think on this show, you know, anyone who's worked with me knows that I don't arrive before the hour call or any sooner than I have to. But I think on this show, given the kind of magnitude of it and the focus, I think that is required, I think it's the first time that I'm going to be at the theatre well and truly before I am required to be, just so I can
focus,
have a breath and focus. Yeah.
Well, chukas to you, Tim, and Sarah Brightman, and Robert Grubb, Ashley Rubinark, and Sylvia Palladino, and a wonderful ensemble of actors that you have in the company.
They really are. Boulevard. Such a wonderful group of incredibly talented, gorgeous people.
Playing the Princess Theatre in Melbourne and then the Opera House in Sydney. We look forward to seeing you. Thank you for your time, Tim. It's been wonderful to chat.
Thank you, mate. Lovely to chat to you. Thanks for having me.
And now, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up. Musical theatre and international recording superstar Sarah Brightman leads a lavish new production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical masterpiece Sunset Boulevard. She co-stars with Stage's guest today, Tim Draxel, in the role of Joe Gillis. Sunset Boulevard weaves a magnificent tale of faded glory and unfulfilled ambition. Having been discarded by Hollywood with the advent of talkies, legendary silent movie star Norma Desmond is tortured by her longing for a return to the big screen. When she meets struggling Hollywood screenwriter Joe Gillis in a dramatic chance encounter, their subsequent passionate and volatile relationship leads to an unforeseen and tragic conclusion. Joining Sarah Brightman is Robert Grubb as Max von Mayerling, Ashley Rubinark as Betty Schaefer, and Sylvie Palladino in the role of Norma Desmond at certain performances. This stellar cast is joined by my guest today, Tim Draxel, in the role of Joe Gillis. It's as if we never said goodbye. Welcome back, Sunset Boulevard. Opera Australia and GWB Entertainment, by arrangement with the really useful group, present Sunset Boulevard, the musical theatre event of the year. Don't miss this strictly limited season at Melbourne's Princess Theatre from May and at the Sydney Opera House from August 2024. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.